rich. So now we're going to move on. We've looked at data and some of the things that you can do with big data. We're now going to hear from Hans Neve and Michael Ginsbach at the Remediation Division of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency about how they were using and applying data to produce a statewide map of groundwater contamination for the state's active Superfund sites. So, with that said, I want to hand it over to Hans and Michael.
All right, hello. It's great to be here with you today to talk about our groundwater contamination mapping project. We've been at this for 2.5 years, and now we've got about 7 months left. What the groundwater contamination mapping project will do is we'll produce a map that shows areas of groundwater contamination in a way that's useful to the technical audience, but also understandable by the general public. So I'm going to give an overview, and then Michael will fill in the details, which he is so good at. So there are questions. They're not new questions, though. The questions have always been there. What is new is the frequency and the intensity at which they're asked of us. It really is true that the groundwater issues aren't out of sight, out of mind anymore. We're getting a lot more media coverage. There's a lot more people at the table, people that weren't at the table before, and that is a great joy. It makes life so much more interesting to have the wholeness there. More media coverage. We're having public meetings now that have more citizens than government employees. And that's not always been the case, but it's not just there's more citizens. Sometimes these meetings are standing room only now because of the issues that have been triggered. We've also had to upgrade the security that we have at the St. Paul Office of the Pollution Control Agency. And the reason is because now we have protesters. Protesters of all different sort of shapes and sizes. We've got people with pit bulls and kids in strollers and signs that say TCE, and there was one really interestingly painted school bus that sort of showed up. We also have the most requested files in state government. So all these things are symptoms, what I would call symptoms of a data accessibility gap. Okay, so what are we doing? We've got the groundwater contamination mapping project, which will produce an interactive web-based map of areas of groundwater contamination. It starts with, and this is what it's been, 2 years of what I'm going to call data harvest. We're starting with information data in sort of boxes. The fact that they're electronic boxes doesn't make them any less of a box. We got data in boxes. Moving that into an enterprise database. Once we have the database sort of populated, then we're going to open the door on the cage and turn the data loose in the wild with this web-based interactive map that will show areas of groundwater contamination. We were kind to ourselves. We only committed to the legislature to deliver the Superfund sites, 93 active Superfund sites. That's not going to be enough. What they'll get will be the Superfund sites and a little bit of more, and in years to come, much, much more. This is the platform that's being built. So our reports have a pretty consistent anatomy. And as it turns out, the text is often but a thin veneer on the overall mass of the document. This is just what the anatomy is. Often the tables and the figures are a little more, but what really makes a massive report massive is the data. We really do have a system where data lives in documents. And it doesn't work anymore to do it this way. So we're making a shift, a transition from an old way where data lives in documents to a new way where the data lives in a publicly accessible database. That's what we're doing. The groundwater contamination mapping project is a great first step in that. But as it turns out, it's not going to get us to this transformation that we need to have, because the groundwater contamination mapping project starts with the data harvest. So the whole time we're doing the data harvesting and building the map and making the areas of contamination, we're also collecting new data, which is arguably the most important data. So if we don't have a system that gets us set up to have the new data flow right into our database, we're going to be right back where we started some number of years from now with data living in documents. So we need the data harvesting project to catch us up, groundwater contamination mapping project, and we need what I'm going to call the Equus implementation project for the future. So Equus is the database that we're using, the enterprise database that will hold the data. Right now we're in pilot 3 on this. If you're a state contractor, you know all about this because you're doing it. You're doing it right now. You're getting data, formatting it in an electronic data deliverable and submitting it to us, and it flows into our database. As we roll this out in September 2020 and then in January 2021, the plan is all the data flowing into the remediation division would come to us on electronic data deliverable and flow into the database. And then from the database, it would flow out to anybody who wants it. So this really is what I'm going to say, the tale of two projects. We need these two projects to make this data transformation. And we need it now more than ever with the file review requests we have, with the issues that are before us, with the ways we need to communicate, and the we need to bring people up to a base level of knowledge about what these things mean. So that's what we'll have. We'll have a system where our data is living in a database, and it's publicly accessible. And it still won't get us what we need. The data is super important, and it actually won't be enough for what we need to do. So you've heard this theme, this is a reoccurring theme. We didn't talk to each other as speakers and like say, well, you know, what are your messages? But this is, I think we sort of all arrived at this on our own through experience. So I'd maybe explain it, or maybe let's do this. Think about a play or a movie that you saw that was really compelling. Okay, and then remember back to like when it was done, what that was like what that did to your system, like what you were feeling, the effect that it had on you, like the traction that this thing had. You may have gone to bed and got up and it was still there. You might have been still thinking about it. You're like a different person after that. A really good movie, a really good play will do that. So I'll contrast that with experiences you've had of looking at a data table. Or reviewing an annual monitoring report, okay? Different, yes? It's different, okay? It's not that one is better or worse than the other. There's no value judgment. There's just different levels of traction, okay? Why is that? Why is a story compelling in a way that a data table never could be? So this is why. Because that story, it lands in your feeling system, which, as it turns out, has much more capacity, much more power than your thinking system. That's just the way it works out. It's not a value judgment. It's just something that's true. Okay? To be an effective scientist in 2019, you have to also be willing to do feelings. That's just how it works out. Okay. What it means from the communication standpoint is the more we can transmit the messages that the data is telling us, the more we can transmit that in a way that will land in the feeling system of another person, the more effective it's going to be. And the way this works out, the physics of the way the feelings work out, is it's not linear, it is exponential. So doing just a little bit of it can have a really huge effect. We started this project 2.5 years ago as a data accessibility project. This is the presentation we gave to the LCCMR. It was a data accessibility project that was critically important. Absolutely true. It's a data accessibility project. We have to do it. As we're getting to the end, to building the thing that we're going to deliver in June of this year, we're realizing actually this is more than that. This is a storytelling project. That's what we're working on. There'll be generally three elements. There'll be the data download that I know many of you are interested in, super important to be able to get the data out, the raw data to everyone. The other two elements are a map that will have data points. These are wells where we have analytical data. Michael will talk a little more about this. It's going to be more the case that people don't care so much about what program you're working in. So to that theme, if it's data in the database, it's going on the map. Doesn't matter if it's a Superfund site or a closed landfill site or a petroleum site, an open landfill site, ambient monitoring program site. If it's in the database, the point goes on the map. And then for the legislative grant, we're making maps that show areas of contamination for the 93 active Superfund sites. I'm the manager of the closed landfill program at the Pollution Control Agency. We have a closed landfill program do it also with a different funding stream. A map with points. Areas where we can draw areas of contamination for some programs with a lot more to come. Areas of properties where the source came from, what the source of the contamination is. That's essentially the map. A temptation that will sabotage the map is to put more than that on the map. Okay? But more, a lot more is needed. A lot more is needed. When you look at this map, you're going to have questions. Things like, what is this? And how did this happen? You know, what's been done? And what are you going to do about it? And what does this mean for me, for my health, for my property value, for things that are important to me? What does it mean? Best to do that with an accompanying story, to really use the power that the story has to communicate that. Three things this will be: map, story, and data download. And that's sort of the overview. I'll turn it over to Michael now to talk about the details.
Thanks, Hans. So I'm going to start very, very high level at this point, as you can see by this overwhelming graphic with a lot of text on it, to just kind of drive home how important this is. Is this something that we as groundwater professionals and hydrogeologists and people who are interested in groundwater, is this our primary focus only, or are there other people who care about this issue as well? I've thrown up here, for those of us who are at the MPCA, you have seen this before, hopefully many times. For those of you who haven't, welcome to the 16 strategic goals for the MPCA from 2018 to 2022. I have taken the initiative here, so you don't have to read the entire thing. You're more than welcome to, if you'd like to, of highlighting on the bottom right, central right, with a red box to show one of our strategic goals at the agency as a whole is to accelerate the availability of data and information in a self-service format. This comes from our commissioner's office. This comes from real high-level folks in the agency. So it's encouraging for me to see something like this where, as a data aficionado, where I really want to get this data out to people, you guys want to have the data work with it. We have support for this at every single level of our agency. And as a matter of fact, it's one of our 16 strategic goals over the next 4 years. So we are not going alone on this. We are bringing the entire agency forward. And as Hans mentioned, we are going to be moving from data living in documents and having data live into a database, have it be accessible, and have it be available to everyone. So that's the high level. Let's step way, way back. I'm going to get pretty far into the details here, so bear with me. We've been working on this project for about 2.5 years at this point. This was an LCCMR-funded project. We have a very strict time frame on it, and we had to really prioritize. This is a very large-scale project that encompasses, as Hans mentions, our 93-ish active Superfund sites in the state, plus anything else we can get in within that 3-year time frame. So from 2017 to 2019, we were in a data harvest as part of this, which is a very exciting name for a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that myself and the student workers and the hydrologists on the project poured into getting data from that document form into our database form. Our first phase on this, which took us an extremely long period of time, was getting groundwater well locations at state Superfund sites. In some cases, we were able to use the county well index information. However, the way that our cleanup programs work is we'd have a lot of temporary wells. We have a lot of wells that are not deep enough, don't last long enough to be in the county well index. So we had a team of individuals who were working on this to transcribe all that information from a contractor report into our database format. Once we had that done, we set the stage and went to our analytical results. If you're trying to show areas of groundwater contamination and you don't have analytical results, it can be very difficult to try and produce something that someone is going to believe you on. So we spent a lot of time working on that to get those data into our database and work forward with that. Phase three, which is kind of a nebulous ongoing project, is groundwater well locations, analytical results from other key remediation sites. This list of 93-ish Superfund sites is just a very, very small portion of our overall remediation division. If you count in our petroleum remediation sites, our closed sites, our brownfields, our voluntary investigative cleanup, our RCRA corrective actions, the closed landfill sites, the open landfill sites, which are not remediation, but I'm going to bring them in here with us anyway, there's thousands of locations across here. Again, we are unfortunately limited by our time frame and our funding source, so we're not able to do all those, but we're getting as much as we can, bringing everyone in the agency together on it. You could ask almost anyone at the agency, and They may have seen me in passing. I have a tendency to stand out, as you guys may or may not be able to tell. But at some point, I'm sure I've mentioned at least something about this to almost everyone at our agency. This is a very, very large scale thing. Which brings us to today. So in 2019, we are working on our mapping portion. So we have a team that has transitioned from data collection, from gathering information from specific locations, and are now working to make that data meaningful, accessible, and usable. As Hans mentioned, we didn't plan this, but we did really fit in well with the other talks that were going on throughout here too. So we have a situation where we have folks who are very interested in our raw data, our individual data points to use in their own processes. We also have my 91-year-old grandfather in West Central Minnesota who doesn't know what a well is, aside from he knows he's got to pay a contractor to come clean it out every so often. This is something that we need to make accessible to everyone and bring it back together. So what we're doing now is taking these individual data points that I'll talk about in a little bit and make these areas of contamination, make it something that's digestible and easy for folks to understand. The team is working very, very hard at this. Once those are done, we will begin our peer review of the groundwater contamination maps and data sets, where we sit down with our project managers and our hydrogeologists. As you are all aware, you know, you sit down three hydros in a room to try and review something, and you'll end up with six different opinions. So we want to make sure this is something that's defensible for us as we start putting it out there. And as you can see by this bright purple square on the far right, we are hoping to have all this done by May 2020. So this is a large-scale project. We've gone through six or seven different team members on this. We have everyone in our remediation division. We have an entirely separate division of our IT who are helping build this web-based map. And we're on track. Things got a little rough for a while there, but we're good. We are on track to finish this by May 2020. So let's get really far into the details here. We've all seen contractor reports. We've all seen contractor drilling reports. We've probably generated a number of them ourselves. So what happened in the initial stage of the project is our student workers sat down and transcribed our sample information to electronic data deliverable. They took that initial step that Hans was talking about. They took the data from living in a document and brought it into a format that our database could accept. These included information like the unique well numbers, the coordinates, the well construction information, where if we had county well index information, we would, of course, gobble that up and take that as could be. But a lot of these, you know, it was locked up in a report from 1987 was the only source we had of this. These were taken from printer reports, PDF reports, spreadsheets, all sorts of data sources. These could be found in our digital file storage, in physical storage systems, and in long forgotten boxes from someone who had retired 5 years ago, and we just haven't had a chance to, you know, get this scanned in yet. We did a very exhaustive search for all these things to try and see what was going on, try and bring it all back together, and the student workers did an absolutely fantastic job, and you'll see in the results a little bit later what's going on there. One of the initial things that we really were struggling with on this were location unique identifiers. This is driven by the fact that, especially in our Superfund program, these are decades-long cleanup efforts. These are not, you know, a one-and-done sort of thing where you go out there and 6 months later everything is clean. These are multi-year, multi-contractor, multi-landowner sort of projects as part of it. And when you have a site that's had six different consulting firms working on it, it can be very difficult to try and figure out what MW1 is when there's seven different MW1s in part of the... So we spent a lot of our initial efforts on this going through and trying to standardize. EQUIS, which is the state's environmental database we're working with on there, is a relational database. And one of those keys that we really need as part of this is unique identifiers. So for things like permanent monitoring wells, super easy. We sent them over to our friends over at MGS and MDH to get the unique well number and bring those in together. Things like temporary wells and boreholes, which didn't have a defined CWI number, we worked with them on that too to get that together. Things that really don't fit into that schema, that are not really actually wells by any means, you know, indoor air samples, outdoor air samples, subslab gas samples, surface soil samples, lake streams, wetlands, these are all data that we collect as part of the remediation division. Some of these may not have fit into our groundwater contamination mapping project. I mean, theoretically, they could have. But as Hans mentioned, we also have our EQUIS implementation plan to try and bring this all back together. So we sat down, have database constraints, have ways to communicate to our consultants and our partners as part of this, how we get unique identifiers. So every data point that we bring into our environmental database has a unique number that is only assigned to that. And you can ask the student workers, this was a lot easier said than done. There was a lot of time spent as part of this. So I got ahead of myself in the last slide, but we use EQUIS at the state, which is the state's enterprise database for environmental data. But it's not our only source of data, as I've hinted at over and over again. So our county well index is our primary source for well information for our permanent wells. And depending on which well you're looking at on here, the MPCA, the DNR, the Department of Ag, the Department of Health, and the MGS all have data primacy over certain wells in the database. How do we deal with these sorts of things? How is it when one of the student workers transcribes a well and we have something that doesn't quite match up with a county well index? How do we deal with that? These are all questions that, you know, when we initially started this project were not on the table, but we quickly identified those and brought them back together. County well index is the formal standard for these. What happens if I've got a survey from 2 years ago with better coordinates as part of this? Equus as a whole, with our data implementation, with this project and with the ongoing stuff, is going to serve a vital role in improving our interagency communications. This is going to bring information together, make it accessible, and take it from that document and bring it into a database where we are able to use it in a meaningful way. Sorry, I'm checking my watch because I am very long-winded. Hans said I'm good at the details, but that's just a nice way to say I talk a lot. So as we get into this, we establish over 14,000 unique locations as part of this project over about a year. So we had 11,000 permanent wells and over 3,000 temporary wells and boreholes that were established. Each one of these has a unique identifier associated with it. It's in our database. We have coordinates for these. You can pop on, and if you wanted to, grab this coordinate information. It's all out there. So for those 14,000 unique locations, we have 36,000 samples that were collected from each of these. With over 545,000 results. All of this, again, is tied into our database, is able to be pulled down, will be able to be pulled down, excuse me, once we have everything up and running on this. So this is a lot of data. This fits into a lot of what we've talked about earlier. Some of us may love this. You see 545,000 analytical results, and you're chomping at the bit to get that in there to run your models, to bring everything back together. Some of us may be overwhelmed by that. This is a lot of information. So we took this and we kept this into consideration. We brought this back together. There are different audiences for all this data. And this is why we have this report flow. So as mentioned in the previous presentation, I'm an advocate of Python, so I was loving to see all that good stuff coming across there. We have our raw data, our data from our report that gets moved into a database and that comes into a map. So there's all these different steps, these transformative efforts that are done to this data to get it out there. We bring it back together, we look at it, we aggregate it, we bring it back together, we don't look at QC data when we're trying to map it up there, but we get all the pertinent information and have that ready to go. So this map data flow is a lot of behind the scenes steps. So again, transcribed from the report, put into the database, and from the database it goes through a series of efforts that our IT staff have put back together to try and make it so it's usable, accessible, and ready to go for everyone. If you're just throwing out 545,000 raw numbers, no one's going to be able to use it. But if we pare that down, if we have these compared to standards, to things that are meaningful, again, think back to my grandfather in Western Minnesota, he may not care what the concentration of TCE is at the well, but he may care if it is something that he can drink or if he needs to put a filter on as well associated with this. And as Hans mentioned too, and as the other presenters have mentioned this morning, this is all about the story. You can put this information out there, you can have these areas, you can have these points, and people may not be able to figure out what's going on with it. You know, it might be a pretty color on a map, but is that something you should be concerned with? You know, if you live in Minneapolis and you have groundwater contamination below your house, are you worried about your drinking water supply? So we realized that as we were doing this project and brought it back together and brought in the story portion as well too. So the data without the story doesn't really tell you what's going on. And that's being done the same way. We are going back to the reports. We are talking with the people who have been involved with these projects from the start. We are taking that information, bringing it into an enterprise database where it can be updated, where it can be kept alive. If you go onto the PCA's website right now, there are some site stories for these Superfund sites, and there's one of them in particular that has a movie ad that came out from 2003 on a screenshot of a MapQuest map associated with it. Not ideal. It was something with penguins. I don't remember which one it was. Didn't do very well, obviously, because I don't remember the title. But we don't want that to happen anymore. We don't want 15-year-old data to be out there, especially as we have an agency-wide initiative to make our data accessible and self-service. So instead of having that be a static document that lives in one place that's very hard to update with a series of steps, talking with communications, getting document numbers, getting all the stuff through, if we can keep that in an enterprise database and make it part of our workflow, these things are going to be up to date, they're going to tell a story, and they're going to support the data. These two are going to mesh back together, and they're going to really, really give us a good picture of what's going on with our groundwater contamination in the state of Minnesota. So you guys are going to see a draft version of the website next on the map. This is hot off the press. A couple days ago, I downloaded this. So this is that culmination of this entire thing. There's data points on here, but it's made in a way that's accessible and easy to digest for folks. One of the things that we did on here is, what is our goal? At the PCA, and especially in the remediation division, we are about communicating risk to human health and the environment. So for our areas of contamination that we have on here, we had to delineate something. We had to pick something. Do you go with detects? How do you deal with non-detects and the rising detection limits on a lot of these analytical methods? Do you go with standards to a health-based standard, which is what we ended up doing on this too? So we went to our colleagues over at the Minnesota Department of Health and looked at our health-based limits over there, our health risk limits, our risk assessment advice, all of these other things, all these health risk limits that associate with them, and help take these data, these individual points where you may not know if 0.38 is something good or if 0.49 is even worse or better. You don't know what's going on here, and try to digest this and bring this back in a way that folks can understand, which ended up on our symbology here, which you can kind of see. Is this going to work? No. That's all right. You guys can look at it anyways. Where we've got these bins for this data. We had to try and figure out how to take this wide range of information and get it into some way that's digestible to the public. So we have dots on here with the red dots above a health-based limit. We have on here our purple squares, which are ones that are below health-based guidance but are detects. So that's meaning and saying that there's something here, but you're actually okay. You don't have to worry about this right now. And then there are the blue dots, which got cut off on the legend over there, but those are locations where we had non-detects of our contaminants of concern. This information is out there, it's accessible at first glance, but all the supporting metadata, you know, this entire range of things from the individual data points out to the high-level communications are all accessible and brought out there. So you can see off on the side that this has a CWI number, it's associated there. The colloquial name is MW19 because 579471 may mean something, but when you're talking with the folks who are working on this or who are trying to bring that data together, MW19 means a lot to them. We can see when it most recently exceeded our standards that we're looking at, which analytes were exceeding the standard, and what the results were if there was multiple coming across in there too. One of the things on this is that this is just that forward-facing. As Han mentioned earlier, there's going to be a data download portion where those of us who really want to get into the meat and potatoes here can download it all and work with it together. But if you just want a high-level overview or in the public, you can take a look here. We've got our areas of contamination on here with some level of certainty associated with them, where you can see where we've got brackets on the outside. Those have a solid line versus the dotted line where we're not quite sure what's going on here. So this is all well and good, but this only tells half of what we're looking at here. So we're developing these narratives, these ideas to help make us connections to that data and bring it back together. And this is a lot of the stuff that Hans was talking about earlier. So learn about it. Try and tell that story. Try and make that emotional connection, that story that tells you something, because you're not going to remember the data points when it comes to tomorrow unless someone's at your house, but you might remember the story of what's gone on. Where did this contamination come from? What contamination are we even looking at? You know, is there groundwater contaminated here? Does the drinking water actually pull from this? What treatments are in place? Am I safe at my house drinking this water? Do we have other media that we're concerned about that are in phase two of this project? Soil, sediment, indoor air contamination, all of this good stuff. What have the state been doing? Did they know about this? Have people just kind of been leaving this in the ground for how long? What's going to be coming next? And then contacts. So this is that second part of it. The data is in the initial part. The second part is the story, this portion that brings you back together and connects you to it, and then lets you know, hey, who do I talk to if I want to learn more about this? So there's a ton of benefits to this project. So we're making our map and our data accessible to internal staff, external parties, and the public. Each one of these has their own level of detail that they're going to be looking at associated with this. Each one has their own information that they're hoping to glean, that has that story that they want to learn about. And I think we've got a nice multi-tiered approach in this where we can successfully meet all of these. And this, as mentioned, it's a storytelling project. It's a data transformation project. So our information is now going to be easily accessible. It's going to be on the web. We've mentioned that a few times on this. This is going to be able to be going to on the PCA's website, be able to pull all this information directly off there. All the data is going to be on the Geospatial Commons. We are making this easily accessible. We're also making it well documented, so you know where this data comes from, where you have this analytical data. The DNR is well trusted. Sometimes people don't trust the PCA. So we have the QC data that's going to be accessible with this too, so you can independently verify that. So it's well documented. You can see when it was collected, what's going on with this. This is meaningful information and usable information. This is data that is pertinent to folks, that impacts where they live, and you're actually able to use it. You don't have to take it on face value. You can, if you want to, like I said, you can just take a look at the surface level stuff, or you can dig into the details and see what's going on.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions? Let's see. I see Kelton has a question. No surprise.
I'll try and quickly say my multiple questions. There's a third dimension to all these plumes. How is the story being told about that on your website? And for pulling down the data, what do you need on your end? Is Excel Lite going to be enough? Or maybe you could say something about that too.
Sounds like a detailed question.
Yeah. So there's going to be a series of graphics that Hans hinted at on his last slide on this associated with it. We're going to have cross-section. So we struggled a lot as we were trying to look at this to say, how do we convey this third dimension? As you talk with folks about groundwater issues, trying to say beneath your feet, 175 feet down, there's a layer of sand and that's where your well is screened, goes over the head of most folks. So we went back and forth and back and forth, and some of us wanted really, really detailed information about this, and I'm not pointing any fingers, but it was me. And some of us wanted something that's accessible and easily out there. So those cross-sections that Hans showed are going to show our areas of contamination. Each of the wells is going to have the depth and the stratigraphic information associated with it, but there's going to be graphics on there, too, to try and help convey that information and drive it home. The data download, part of it's going to be an implementation of our current groundwater EDA system. So you'll get tab delimited text files for each of the wells you're looking at. With the data going to the geospatial commons, those will be shapefiles, Esri file geodatabases, Excel, any other format that you'll want. And that'll have both the site, the stories, the areas, and the individual data points themselves.
I think it's on. A great presentation. How many do you have plans to bring in Grandma and Grandpa to look at all this before you actually publish it? Do you think there'd be value in having a bunch of regular folks dig in and see if they get it before you finish up? And the second question is, LCCMR is very interested also in that the work that we do does not, I'm sorry, I'm Paul Putz here with DNR, does not end up in another set of boxes, that is, nobody knows it's there and it's inaccessible. I know they've been pushing a lot of us, our projects, to find a way to connect this data. So again, it's not in another box, just a data box, you know, a web box. So Grandma and Grandpa, are they going to look at it? And how are you going to get the word out?
Yeah, Grandma and Grandpa, I actually wanted to do eighth grade science class and a lot of other scope creep ideas for getting outreach before. We should do that. I would love to do that. There's not time. So it's super important to do that. The plan for doing that, and it's hard when you don't actually have the real thing for them to look at either. We really do need to finish that, knowing that this is the first generation of a something. So plan, we've done some, the outreach that we can do with what we have done, which is talking to people who are smart about this, who've been through other communication experiences before, we feel pretty good about what we have. And once it's launched, that's the time we would really do that detailed public feedback, because we're in a better spot for it. And you're asking about the future as well. This is something that we're going to be keeping up updated long term. It's one of our new communication platforms. This is part of the discussion that happened when we received the funding, that the agency would agree to take care of this and keep it updated long term.
Thank you. Dan Card, MPCA. Two questions, one looking in the past and one forward. Given the finite budget and time limits that you had, how far back, in other words, what's the cutoff year by which you gather data from reports? First question. And then looking ahead, as risk-based numbers and standards changed, how will those maps be updated? Is it a manual process or is it done automatically?
Michael and I are going to split it. You're asking about the time limit. How far do we go back? Well, we'll kill a data harvesting project is not putting a limit on how far you go back. So we got the grant, and then I went to bed and got up, and I had a panic attack when I got up about what have I signed up for? Because I had a kind of an idea how we would do this, but a lot of details. I felt like I'd really stuck my neck out on it, and I did. As it turns out, there was really only one way to get the analytical in, and that was not going back to transcribing or paper reports. We had to get it from labs out of their LIMS system. And so thankfully that worked, so we're only going back 5 years. It's what the data we can have available. It's the best data set available because it contains all the QA, and it's more or less complete. It's 5 years is how far we went back.
As our risk-based standards change associated with all of this, those are also values stored in our relational database that comes across here. So the symbology will change as our hurls drop, as those things change on it, our areas. If you want to learn more about this, our student workers and our hydrologists have a poster in the poster hall. It's a quick little nudge for those guys over there. But the areas can be anywhere from being manually generated. These can be things that we have gone through and looked at good contractor reports and geo-referenced those. Or these can be things where we actually don't have enough wells to draw an area around it. So the point symbology will change automatically with the changing standards. The areas will have to be looked at and done manually.
John Seberg with DNR. And Kelt had asked about the third dimension, as you're going to be showing the extent of contamination. What about the fourth dimension, going through time? I mean, a case of point would be TCAP, where you have decades of data. You can almost do an animation of these things. How is that going to be handled?
We have some really amazing senior staff on this project, and one of their primary roles was to deal with my ideas of scope creep, which, if allowed to move forward, would have killed the project. This is one of them. I mean, I had like visions of YouTube videos that showed where the plume was going to go. All that's great stuff. I would like to get there. Hopefully, I will at some point, but right now we need to focus on just the footprint that we have it now, the data set that we have. But yeah, it's the fourth dimension time. It's important. Hopefully, it's something to come yet.
Bill Olson, Dakota County. Well, I was going to ask the question about time. Let's see. I'll ask the question about uncertainty. The maps showed the outline. Have you thought about how to communicate the uncertainty in the outline? And maybe how to communicate what are the alternative hypotheses that are present? I mean, you've got a huge responsibility when you communicate raw data, yes, to not communicate misperceptions. And another source of the uncertainty is the QAQC data that you, I don't know how you'd possibly visualize that on your map.
You are speaking near and dear to my heart right now, because these are things that, you know, Hans had some anxiety early on. These are things that keep me up at night as well, too. So with that uncertainty on the areas, we've got the lines associated with it, with the dash versus the straight line. These are things that the hydrologists on the projects are working on, and we're going to have QC'd by our staff. There's also a whole Q&A section to this website that we didn't show, because it's going to be a bunch of text associated with it that's going to help define this information and talk about how we did this, what we're working on. Our goal is to be transparent and open and be open for suggestions. So if folks have any information, any idea of how to help out with this, we would love to have it. One of the good things about having our QAQC information in this relational database format is we are able to run some sort of automated checks on this. So theoretically, each one of these data points has been vetted by a project manager or a hydrologist and used to make site decisions associated with it. One of the things that we're really cognizant of, and what's really nice about getting the raw data directly from the LIMS at the labs, is that all that QC is associated with it. So we are working on some internal tools with the Equus database, with a data qualification module, with some little scripts that I've written to try and pull this data together to apply these QC values associated with this to see, does this meet our goalposts? Is the MSMSD samples, are these legit for this? Does this work together? So there's data qualification that's going to be on this as well, too, each of these points. And the QC package will be available when you download it all yourself. So we're going to do as much as we can on our 545,000 analytical reports and have the data out there to let third-party validators and verifiers help us out with this project, too.
Add one thing to that about working with the labs. What we got from them was data we already had. Okay, so there's no other flow of data or data that is between a client and the lab that we don't have. Our data was already submitted to us. We had it. It was just in paper. All we did is get into a different format.